Okay, I forgot to bring that little machine that I showed up on the slide there last time. I'm sorry, I was going to show it again, but I have some. This is the idea of it, remember, for X-ray scattering. That light comes in. It's a wave that forces things up and down with its electric field. Okay, so that makes the electron or whatever the charged particle is jump up and down. As it accelerates up and down, it emits light in all directions, right? But consider the light that goes just in this direction to hit here, okay? The light, if you have two of them there, the light that comes from this one has a shorter path than the light that comes from this one. And if that difference in path, that tiny gap there, is exactly one wavelength, then as they come out, be as if they're the same wave, they're in phase with one another. So you'll get strong interference here and a strong intensity of light. The same would happen if they went straight ahead, because then obviously they'd have exactly the same path if they hit here. But if they hit here, then they're half a wavelength out of sync, then they destroy one another. But it's going to be smoothly varying, right? If you go just a little bit away from straight ahead, then it'll be not quite as strong because they're a little bit out of phase. Then a little more, a little more, a little more. They completely destroy one another. Then smoothly they come back in phase and back out of phase and so on. So from a pair of particles or a set of particles that are, you know, a finite number of things, a smallish number, there's going to be some interference pattern that's going to vary smoothly as you change the angle at which you look for the light that's coming out there. Now, suppose if what you had was regularly spaced ones, right, in a very long row. Now it's not smooth variation. Again, if you go straight ahead, they'll all be in phase because they'll have the same path. But suppose you diverge such that the difference in phase between the light that's coming from this one and the light that's coming from this one is only 1/100th of a wave. So they practically... It's as if they were in phase, right? They're almost as strong as they would be if they were exactly in phase. But what do you notice if you have a long, long row of these things? If the first one is out by 1 degree, the next one will be out from the first by 2 degrees, and the next one 3, 4, 5, and when you get to the 180th, it exactly cancels the first one. Is everybody with me on this? Nod if you see. Shake your head if you don't see. I'll say it again if you want me to say it again. Say it again? Okay. So they're scattering from this one and scattering from this one. They go out of this. If they go out straight ahead, they have exactly the same path to get the same number of waves, so they're in phase. But suppose they're out of phase by just 1 degree, where 360 degrees is a whole complete change of wave. Suppose they're just a tiny bit out of phase. Okay. So they won't destroy one another. They'll almost perfectly reinforce. But if you have another one, an even row of them, that one will be out by 2 degrees, the next one will be out by 3 degrees, and 4, 5, 6, and if you get to the 180th degree, it's exactly out of phase with the first one, and it'll cancel the first one. And the next one will cancel the second one, the next one will cancel the third one. So there won't be anything. So they have to be, if it's a long, long, long row, an infinitely long row, then they have to be precisely in phase. You have to choose the angle at which they come out so that the phase difference between the first and the second is exactly 360 degrees if you want them to reinforce for the whole set of them. Is that clear now? I still don't see a lot of nods, but I'm going to guess that it's clear, and you can read it on the web page if it's not. Okay, so then what you'll see in the scattering is a bunch of fine points. Okay, so if it's just two things or a small number of things, then there'll be some smooth variation. If it's a regularly repeating thing, then you'll have only very special angles, repeating angles at which it comes out like that, so you'll get discrete points. Okay, now suppose what you have is an infinite row of evenly spaced things, but what's being repeated is a pair. Now you have both things going on. You have the scattering from a pair, which is smooth variation, and you have the scattering from this row of evenly spaced things, which gives only certain points. And that's what happens in a crystal, because the electrons are doing the scattering. They're in molecules in a given pattern, but then the molecules in a crystal are evenly spaced in an infinite row, an infinite two-dimensional lattice, an infinite three-dimensional lattice. Okay, so this is what you have. Okay, now, so we want to understand the X-ray diffraction from crystals modeled by these sets of what we call benzenes here. Okay, as a what's called a convolution from both these influences, that it's a certain pattern that's causing a smooth variation. But then, that pattern is on a lattice, right, which will give only certain points. So, and we demonstrated this at the end last time. Okay, so first, the first slide from hexagons we show, they were all oriented, but they're not on a lattice. They're randomly distributed. So now you'll see only, you won't get that point effect, right, because they're not on a lattice. So it's as if, indeed, it's as if you had just one, but you get, it's much stronger if you have a zillion of them there. Okay, so it's visible. Okay, so there's the isolated, so it's as if it were scattered by isolated benzene, and here's the pattern that we saw, sort of a snowflake. Now what we want to do is understand this pattern, why the benzene looks like that. The benzene is six-fold symmetric for rotation, and the pattern is six-fold symmetric. That seems pretty likely. But why does it have the shape it does? Why are the intensities the way they are? So remember, the trick was to look for evenly spaced lines or planes of electron density, of atoms, right? And then see where you're going to get constructive interference from those. Because everything that's on a plane, if you scatter in same angle in and out, those will be in phase. So if we pick them to be on a line, all the ones on the line will be in phase. And then if you have evenly spaced lines, then if from the first one you have a given wave, from the next one you have a wave that has one wavelength longer to get out, it'll be in phase. The next one will be two waves out, three waves out. So everything will be in phase. So all we have to do is look at this pattern and see if we can find a set of parallel lines. And then we can figure out what's going on. And of course you can see it. They all lie on those evenly spaced parallel lines. So we can have the light come in and bounce from each of those. And if that difference in path between successive lines is the red shown there, if that's exactly one wavelength, then you'll get strong intensity. Now suppose you chose a slightly different angle. Not exactly that angle, but close to it. Then what? Are you going to get anything? Josh, what do you say? Slightly less, but it's not like this infinite row of things where the 180th will cancel the first one kind of thing, right? Because there are only a few of them there in this pattern. So it'll be a little bit less intense. So it'll be fuzzy. The pattern won't be sharp, right? And you see things are fuzzy. And that, if you connect these as a parallelogram like that, right, then it's sort of neat. I mean, I don't have enough arms to do it, but you'd go like this. You know, imagine it's hinged here, right, and you squash it up and down, right, and the one at the top will move up and down as I change the angle. See what I'm talking, right? And that tells you where that thing is going to be, and it's going to be up there, right? So it's that one, but of course by symmetry also that one, that one, that one, that one, that one. So those six fuzzy spots are the scattering that comes from planes that are like that. But there are other ways of finding parallel planes in this pattern, not just that. Okay, for example, you could take those two planes, right? Now, if you want to get those two planes exactly one wave apart from one another, you need a smaller angle than you had before. It's got to be like that, because now that's going to be exactly what the red was in the previous one, one wave. But since these two are further apart from one another, the angle has to be smaller for that to be the same as it was before, that red part. Okay? So it's a smaller angle. And if we try that one out, wait a second, there's something else. You say there are more of them in between there. Those are still there. What are they going to be doing to scattering at this angle? If the difference in phase of the waves between scattering from here and scattering from here is exactly one wavelength, how about the scattering from these two on that intermediate plane? What do you say? It'll be half a wavelength, and what will the effect of that be? It'll cancel two of them. There were four in phase before, from the top and the bottom. Now there are two that are canceling. They'll cancel two of those. So you'll get scattering, but it'll be weaker. Net only two rather than four or six. Got it? Okay. So it'll be scattering there, but much weaker than it was before. So there should be intense, fuzzy intensity there. Okay, but again, that's not the only way of doing it. And notice, incidentally, that greater spacing of these lines gives smaller angles of scattering. That is, the first one where the lines were close together was up here. Now when we're considering these planes, we see that there should be some scattering there. So greater spacing gives smaller angles. Now, look for electron density on or near the evenly spaced planes, because if they're near those planes, they're going to be almost the same phase as if they were on them. Okay, so now, look, we could take those two planes, though the atoms don't lie exactly on them, but they lie near them. So they'll be almost in phase with one another. Okay, and now that'll scatter like that to be one wave apart, right? And it'll give rise to those yellow ones. Everybody see that? And all six by symmetry. Okay? So there's the... And also we could take that set of planes. Now, notice there's nothing on this plane in the middle, right? But the others have atoms on them. So you have this evenly spaced set of planes, and all the atoms are going to be in phase. And where is that going to come? Scattering from that. Can you see? Yeah, out to the right and left. How far out? Not very far, very far. This is very tiny spacing, so it'll give a very high angle of bend to the X-rays, right? So you can see it, it's out here. See, there's just a little bit there, and up here, those places. Okay? Now, that's very weak. Those are very weak compared to the others, even though all the atoms lie on those planes. There's nothing canceling each other. Why is it so weak? Because there, in fact, is some cancellation. Because these planes are so close together compared to the size of the spots that there has to be density halfway between. Right? Because the spacing is small compared to the size of the things you're trying to see. Right, so it gets very weak. Okay, so high angle reflections are always weak because the finite size of the scatterers gives substantial electron density between the closely spaced planes. Okay, so now we understand that pattern. Now let's go to what we get if we had a whole bunch of those in a lattice. Each of those individuals is giving that snowflake pattern, and now we want to add up all the snowflake patterns and see what we'll see. Okay, so let's just look at one of them to begin with. And we've already seen that. It gives that snowflake pattern. But, of course, it's only one. So it's going to be very, very, very weak. So we'll make it really weak. Okay? And now, to simplify things, we'll only look at scattering up and down. We won't look at the whole two dimensions. We'll just look at that row there. But we can hardly see it because it's only a single molecule. Right? But now, if we're interested only in scattering up and down, these are all going to be in phase with one another along that row. Okay? So that'll give enough intensity maybe to see a little, or at least to see better. And they'll all be in phase with one another, so it'll be n times what we saw before. Okay. Actually, to tell you the truth, it's n squared. How many are there? Because intensity is proportional to the square of the height of the wave. But that's a minor point. Okay? So remember, each of those molecules is smoothly varying as you go up and down for different angles of scattering. They vary smoothly in that way shown there. And that's what we just saw in the previous slide where we analyzed why it should look a certain way. Okay, so a single molecule would do that, a row of molecules would do that, but give more intensity. Now, suppose you took two rows of molecules. Now there's going to be interference between those two rows. right? So they'll come in phase, out of phase, in phase, out of phase as you change the angle. So superimposed on this, what's coming from individual molecules or rows of molecules is going to be this thing, which comes from the interference of one row to the next, coming in and out of phase. So you take those two together and multiply them, and you see the snowflake, but it has horizontal bars on it because you're having interference from two rows. But again, it's sort that part of it is smoothly varying, although on a very small scale, right? Now we take the whole bunch of them, and now what's going to happen? Can somebody tell me? Now, because we have an infinite row of evenly spaced things, they're only going to be very, very fine angles at which we can see that snowflake pattern. Okay? And it's going to be like that, and then if we look at it for the whole... So that lattice repeat concentrates the snowflake into very tightly focused spots. The intensity still has to do with the structure of the molecule. But the positions at which you can observe the intensity has to do with the crystal lattice. Okay, and it looks like that then, as we saw last time. But there's the underlying intensity, and then we see it as if through a pegboard. People didn't seem to know what a pegboard was last time. That's a pegboard, right? You can hang hammers and screwdrivers and saws and things on that. Okay, well, put little things in it. But it's as if you're looking through that at this snowflake pattern. So that pattern is caused by the lattice repeats, but the underlying pattern, the smooth snowflake kind of thing, is caused by the molecular structure. So that's what you see in an X-ray picture. Okay, so there, X-ray people talk about two kinds of space, direct space or real space, and that's like a crystal. And diffraction space or reciprocal space, the picture you get from it, right? And the diffraction photo looks like that, these fuzzy things seen through a pegboard, okay? So there's the unit cell structure, the molecular pattern that repeats, and that gives a fuzzy pattern in reciprocal space, in the space of pictures, right? And that's the intensity that you're going to see, right? And then there's going to be a crystal lattice at which you arrange those things, and that in the picture corresponds to the holes at which you can view it, right? So the location of the spots. So the intensity comes from the molecule, and the location where you can see the intensity comes from the crystal, right? And when you have decreasing spacing, things get closer here, the increasing spacing in reciprocal space, which of course is why it's called reciprocal. It's upside down from what you see in the real space. So anyhow, that's how X-ray works. But more, a particularly interesting case was the last one we looked at on Friday, which was scattering by a light bulb filament. So we want to analyze this as what kind of diffraction it's going to give. Okay, and that's the picture that it gave, this X of dots along the X. Okay, now here's a whole bunch of parallel, evenly spaced planes, right, that have lots of wire on them. Notice if you had a plane halfway in between here, like here, it would have only a teeny bit of wire on it. But these have lots and lots of wire on them, right? So that's going to give scattering that goes up to the left, like that, and explains that first spot on the X. Okay? And incidentally, also down to the right. Okay. Now, suppose you had planes that were twice as close to one another, right? Then you have something that's further out, a higher angle, to get one wave difference in path between successive members, right? And there's lots of intensity, lots of scattering coming from this one, a little bit here, lots here, a little bit here. So anyhow, that's going to give the next one. And then if you made them still closer, you'd get the third one and the fourth and the fifth, right? And of course, you also get it down. And of course, you also get it up and down to the right, up to the right, down to the left. Okay, so that explains it. Of course, there's one other thing that we could comment on here. Well, there are several other things. One is that the angle of the X tells what angle these things make, right? because this branch of the X is perpendicular to these lines, and this branch of the X is perpendicular to these lines. So what would happen if you stretched the spring out? What would happen to the X? Here's what it looks like. Stretch the spring out, it'll go like that. Compress the spring, it'll go like that. So that tells you the pitch of the helix, the angle of the X, right? What does the spacing of spots along there tell you? This has to do with the problem that you may have done for today, which is an optional problem, but I do it because it helps you understand what's going on. What does the spacing, we had spacing of dots along the, when we had jail bars there. What did the spacing of the dots tell you? Yeah. Can't hear very well. It tells you the spacing of the jail bars in that case. Or this tells you the spacing of from one to the next of these. It measures it, right? It tells the scale of the picture, right? If you know the wavelength of the light and the distance from the sample to the film, so what angle it is, given lambda in this slide to screen distance. Okay? Now, notice that the spots weaken. This spot is strong, then weaker, then weaker. The fourth one out here is very weak, right? These are all in phase, right, no matter how you slice it here. But the difference is, the reason it gets weaker is that the wire is of finite thickness. So that if you make the planes too close together, within one turn of the wire, some of it is not in phase with the rest. Same as we saw previously with those, with the spots in the hexagon. Okay, so here's Rosalind Franklin's DNA thing, and you see the helix the X tells you it's a helix. That's what it told to Crick, because Crick had been working on protein helices, so he was very familiar with pictures like this. And when he saw that, he said, "Aha! That has to be a helix because it's an X like that with dots along it." But there's another interesting thing about it. Notice the curious intensity sequence. You expect them to get weaker as you go further out for the reason we said. But it doesn't smoothly get weaker. The first one is weak, then strong, then strong, then very weak, and then strong again, or at least not zero. So it's not getting smoothly weaker. Why is that? Well, let's look at a helix. And we know we have that set of planes. But suppose it were a double helix, and you had a set of planes between those original planes. Now, what would that do? So now the planes, if you consider both helices, are twice as close together as they were before. What effect will that have on what you would have seen had it been just a single helix? If it had been a single helix, you'd get an X with a given spacing of dots along it. Now, suppose in truth they're twice as close together because there's one halfway along another one. What would happen? Yeah. Can't hear. Yeah, every other dot would disappear that you'd see in a normal helix. They'd be twice as far apart, is another way of saying it. Okay, so that would destroy all the odd numbered spots. Spot number one would disappear, two would be there, three would disappear, four would be there if they were twice as close together. Right? But suppose. So that would cancel every other reflection. But suppose they were offset from one another like that. Now what you see is a row of pairs. So there's going to be modulation of the intensity of those spots by this sort of molecular structure that you have here, that it's pairs that are repeating. Right? And we've seen several examples of that already. Right? And that's exactly what happens in DNA. That's the atomic structure of DNA. So you have pairs of these things that are repeating, not even spaced. So you don't expect the intensity of the successive dots just to fall off smoothly, but you'll get this modulation. And in fact, you can also see scattering from one side to the other, because there are many more of these heavy phosphorus atoms. Why do I care? Why? I said heavy. Do we care about the mass? Is that what's doing the scattering? What's doing the scattering of X-rays? Pardon me?
Electrons.
Electrons. And the heavy atoms turn out to have more electrons, so they're doing more scattering. So actually it's not the weight, it's the number of electrons we're talking. But anyhow, there are a lot more electrons along here and along here than there are when you look through here. Can you see that? You know, if you looked at if you had a cylinder and you looked at it from the side, and it were, say, just transparent but slightly red, it would look very red here, and it would look very red here, but it wouldn't look very red down the middle because you're looking through a lot more stuff on the sides. So you could draw lines here and here and get scattering sideways, too. And there you see that, these two, right? And in fact, this weak, strong, strong, very weak, strong is exactly the sequence you predict for a certain amount of offset of the double helix. So that's how it was known that it was a double helix of a given diameter and what the space... Now, notice there's a lot of scattering here and here. So where are the planes that would cause that scattering? How far apart are they? Close together or far apart in real space? There must be planes like this that cause scattering up and down. Okay? How far apart are they? Close together? Far apart? They're very close together. It's reciprocal, remember? So there must be horizontal planes in the structure that have lots and lots of electrons on them that are very close together. Right? So we have in this picture the helix diameter, but that's the base stacking. I thought I had a picture of it there, but you know what it looks like. You have these bases that are the A, U, G, C things that are stacked in there, and they're all parallel to one another. You can look at the previous picture if you want to see it. Okay, and that tells you how far apart they are from one another. Okay, so knowing the molecule's electron density, it's really straightforward to calculate a crystal's diffraction pattern. All you have to do is look for these parallel planes of electron density and what distance apart. That tells you what angle you're going to get in a given direction. Then you look at the spacing of the lattice. That tells you where you're going to be able to see those dots. Right? And it's easy as pie to calculate. I mean, it takes some time, but it's very straightforward. But what you'd like to do is do the opposite. Start with the X-ray pattern and figure out what the molecule had to be that gave it. And crystal, what this crystal spacing was. And that's a lot harder. In fact, developing the procedures, the mathematical procedures that allowed doing that, earned the Nobel Prize for people. But now, it's just a part of a program, and any idiot can go and press a button, and the X-ray intensities come in, and the crystal structure comes out, the molecular structure. Especially for a small molecule, it's really simple. If you have a big, I mean, like this past year, the Nobel Prize went for the structure of the ribosome. That wasn't a question of just pressing a button because it was so big and complicated. But for normal organic molecules, it's really easy now. The hard part is actually getting a crystal, not doing the crystal structure once you have it. Okay, so it is possible to go the other way, and that's how X-ray works. Okay, now, what information do you get out of X-ray? Well, you get the electron density at all points in space. And now you have a graphing problem. How are you going to graph, make a picture that you can understand, that shows electron density at all points in space? You could imagine taking a big block of gelatin and a hypodermic syringe with dye in it and injecting a certain amount of dye at every place that corresponded to how much electron density there was there, and then you could look at it and see, right? But that's very labor intensive. Of course, computers can do this kind of thing to a certain extent now. But in the olden days, what we did was print things out on a sheet of paper. I forgot to bring it. I'll bring one next time. I have books that are this big for one crystal structure. Each sheet is a set of numbers printed like this, right? Which is electron density on that plane at a given X and Y position. Okay? And then the next sheet was the next one above it, above, 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 right? And now you have the information, right? So what you do is take a felt tip pen and connect numbers that have the same value and generate a topographic map of the electron density on that particular plane of the sample, right? So they were drawn by hand connecting points of equivalent electron density. And now what you can see is that this particular plane we chose, we could have taken the next sheet or the next one or the next one, but this particular one happened to go very near the middle of a particular atom, of that atom. So it got many, many contours and got up to 492 or whatever that number is there, right? Very high electron density near the nucleus. Okay? But this one here, it didn't. It only cut through the side of the atom, so you didn't get nearly as high, right? But anyhow, you see how you can use that information then to do it. Now, another way of doing it is to plot it on plastic sheets and stack the sheets up. And this was the model made in 1949 of the potassium salt of penicillin. Okay? Now, I say it's the potassium salt of penicillin. The atoms don't come labeled as to what's carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, potassium. Can anybody tell me which one's potassium? Christina? Why? Why should it be the big one?
Because it's more massive than...
Because it's what?
It's potassium's more massive than...
Not massive. What is it about specifically about?
There are more electrons.
There are lots of electrons on potassium. So the potassium is there, and incidentally also there from a different molecule. Okay? Now, here, this particular molecule, rubofusarin, turns out to be planar. So you can choose a sheet that has all the atoms in it. Okay, and this is that sheet. Now, again, this one only has oxygen, carbon, and hydrogen in it. Can you tell the atoms apart? Okay, that one gets up to a maximum intensity of 5 electrons per cubic angstrom. Okay? But that one gets up to 7 electrons per cubic angstrom. And so do those ones up at the top and over on the left. Right? So those are the oxygens, the ones that have more intensity. Okay? Now, what else can we tell about it? Notice here we drew a bunch of single, double bonds and so on, aromatic systems. Can we see that in the X-ray? Okay. Oh, incidentally, there are no hydrogens. Does that surprise you?
No.
Why not? Pardon me?
No electrons.
No electrons. Hardly any electrons on hydrogen, so you can't see hydrogens usually. Okay. Now, look at those three bonds. It says here in the model that this one is a double bond, this one is a single bond, and this one is a single bond, but it's part of a benzene ring, and you could draw it differently. Right? Do you see how you might know that one of those is single, double, and triple? Yeah. Wells? Or what's your name?
Chris.
No, not you. With the glasses, pardon me. What's your name?
Chris.
No, not you. Oh, you have glasses too, Chris. Hi. That's what I thought. I said Wells, but you didn't answer. Okay, yeah. What are you going to say? We'll get you next time, Chris. Ah, so the length of the bond, right? That was short, long, and intermediate for single, double, and one and a half. Okay, like that. Okay, and you see those ones in the middle have the resonance structures, right, down there. Okay, now notice that the atoms are, within experimental error here, spherical. They just look like regular old atoms. Is that what you expected? Is that what Lewis expected for the electron density? What do you think Lewis... We don't know what Lewis would have said. This wasn't done while Lewis was still living. He died in 1942 or something like that. Yeah, what do you... Yeah, they would connect. In fact, if a simple-minded person might say there should be the electron density should be between the atoms. Right? That's where you draw the dots. That's where Lewis drew the dots. He probably wasn't that naive. But it certainly doesn't look like that. There are no electron pair bonds. It's just spherical atoms as far as we can see. And there are no unshared pairs on the oxygens. Right? This is a real kick in the teeth, isn't it? Now, can you see bonds? You can do it by what's called difference density maps. So it looks pretty much as if it's just spheres, of atomic spheres. But is it really atomic spheres? If it were really atomic spheres, and you subtracted from the map you got, all these densities at different positions, subtract from those numbers, the numbers you would predict if it were truly atomic spheres. Right? It looks pretty much like spheres. But suppose you subtract from those numbers what you would predict if it truly were spheres. right? Then you'd see some places where there was more density in the experimental plot than you would have expected for spheres, and obviously other where there's less. So it would show how the electrons shifted in going from just being atoms to being a molecule with bonds. So we could look at this difference density to see how the electrons shifted in forming the bonds. Okay, so what it's sometimes called a deformation density map. And what you take is the observed experimental electron density, which we just talked about getting from X-ray, and subtract the atomic electron density, which usually you get by calculation of what an atom should look like, because you can get that pretty accurately, how its electron density should be. So here's a really neat example by Lazarevich and Berkovich-Yellen from 1975 of this funny molecule that has four benzene rings and then four carbons in a row connected by double bonds. So first, let's look at the electron density of one of the benzene rings. Okay, here it is. And notice this is a difference density map. It's spherical carbon atoms subtracted from the experimental electron density. So they're solid lines, which are where electron density is built up, and they're dashed lines where the electron density came from in order to build it up there. Got the idea? So where did the electron density build up when atoms came together to when carbon atoms came together to form this ring? It built up between the atoms. Here was a carbon, here was a carbon. Electron density built up there, right? Now, notice that he didn't subtract hydrogens. So the hydrogens are still there. And here's one of the hydrogens. So you see it has a lot of electron density very close to the nucleus, but then a little bit shifted out into this region between the hydrogen and the carbon, right? And if you take how much difference density, how much electrons have been shifted, it's about, this is the total electron density there because we didn't subtract anything, and the total is about one electron. That's what the hydrogen would have had. In this bond, there's about a tenth of an electron, that area that built up, a tenth of an electron. Here, in these bonds of the aromatic ring, it's 0.2 electrons built up. Now, if you take a cross-section of that density and turn it sideways to look at it, it's round. The bond is round. Okay? But if you take that one and turn it to look at it sideways, it's oval. Does that surprise you? That it's oval? Why might it be oval? What's special about the bonds between the carbons, these double bonds, or one and a half bonds? Yeah. Pardon me?
They're pi bonds.
They're pi bonds, right? They're made partly of p orbitals, right? And you can see that indeed they are, right? Now let's look at the bonds along here, which I've put here, right? The bonding between this carbon and this one, this one, this one, this one, this one. Okay. First, we already looked at that bond in the previous picture. That had a tenth of an electron in it. That has two-tenths of an electron. The one in the middle has three-tenths of an electron. Okay. Now look at a cross-section of that one, and you can see it's distorted because it has a p orbital in it. Right? That is, it was made partly of those two p orbitals. But the next one, is also oval, but in the perpendicular direction. Right? They go this way. And then the next one, of course, is like the first one. Right? Now, there's some puzzles. We got buildup of electron density in here between those two that made this stretch out. We got it between these two that made this stretch out in the perpendicular direction. But why don't we build up in between those two? Why doesn't the cross-section of this one look circular or like a clover leaf or something, four-leaf clover? Okay? So for this, you got to be patient, right? We'll get there, okay? But notice that it looks as if there are bent bonds from tetrahedral carbon atoms, that the bond between these two is stretched out vertically, the one between these two is stretched out horizontally, and so on. Now, how many electrons are there in a bond? Well, we could make a plot, as Lazarevich did, of single, double, triple bond distances, and also the 1.5 bond of an aromatic ring, the benzene kind of thing. Okay? And this is what Lewis would have told you in terms of bookkeeping. A single bond is 2 electrons. Double bond is 4 electrons. A triple bond is 6 electrons. And a 1.5 bond should be 3 electrons. What's found experimentally? Just that. If you look at that molecule with these things, they're color-coded here. Really good. Just what you expect. Right? And there, those are data from some other molecules I studied with different bond lengths between carbons. So it looks really good, except that the scale has changed. The scale is only 1/20. It's a very small amount of electron density that shifts. You know that if you just look, it looks like atoms. But if you look really carefully by subtracting atoms, you can see these tiny difference densities that are about 1/20 as big as what Lewis would have said. Okay? So, Dönitz in Zurich in Switzerland worked with his very skilled collaborators who are probably grandsons of watchmakers or something. They do really, really precise work. Okay, so they did this molecule, which is aromatic, and it's highly symmetric, so that this is the unique area of it. So we can just, we'll see the whole thing by just looking at part, and this is the figure they gave. So those are these different electron densities in this molecule, which has a number of different kinds of bonds. Okay, it has an aromatic bond there, which you see is stretched out a little bit in the pi direction. Another one there, same thing. It has this single bond. What do you expect its cross-section to look like? Circular, yeah, in cross-section. Right? And then it has a CN triple bond. Now, what should its cross-section look like? Well, pretty reasonable guess would be it looks sort of like a four-leaf clover like that, right? Here's what it looks like experimentally. It's round. It's not distorted. So we'll get onto that when we get to quantum mechanics. And what's this electron density out there? Yeah? The what? All these are electrons, but what electrons? The lone pair on nitrogen, so you can actually see it. That's the unshared pair. What's this? The CF bond. What's funny about it? There's no electrons there. So where is the CF bond? So this raises the second most important question in the course. Right? And you can see it from this. This comes from a very good movie, incidentally. So he says, what do you think of him? Compared with what, sir? Exactly. Compared with what? Remember, when we looked at the electron density map, we had to subtract the atoms. We compared the true density with the atoms. But we had to be careful about what we did. We've seen this question before about resonance stabilization, comparing observed or calculated energy to the energy expected for a single Lewis structure. So difference electron densities we're looking at now. We compare electron density with what we would have expected for undistorted atom. But what's an undistorted atom? That's the question. There's the Pauli principle, which says that you can't have more than two electrons in an orbital. We'll talk about this later. But to avoid problems with that, we need to subtract not an unbiased spherical F. If you had the F atom here that you were subtracting be spherical and averaged, right? There are seven electrons in its valence shell, right? So every quadrant of that would have 7/4 of an electron, right? It would be like that. And what you would be subtracting out would be that. But notice that that's 2 3/4 electrons that you're going to be subtracting out. That's more than can possibly be there. You can't have more than two, right, according to Pauli. So we're subtracting out too much. What you should do is have the F atom not spherical, but prepared to make a bond with just one electron that it's going to share with this. So if you subtracted that instead, then you'd see the bond here. Right? So it's a very subtle problem, but it's a problem of compared to what. Okay? And if you want, you can hear, I would actually recommend it. You can hear Professor Dunitz, who did this, talk about it on the website on a video. Okay? But that's the idea. Compared to what? Okay? And we'll go on to this more work of Dunitz next time. Thanks.